Hi, I'm Orbert Davis, and welcome to the Chicago Jazz Philharmonic Jazz Cast Series, where we sit down with music legends as well as rising stars to hear their stories. This monthly series is all about sharing experience and knowledge with you. Thanks for tuning in. For more, visit chicagojazzphilharmonic.org. Let's do it.
All right, we are live on the air, hanging out. This is our section where we get to enjoy a live podcast, if you will, and learn a little bit more about the music that we love and the music that we play. I'm very honored to have as our guest for this very brief time, Mr. Robert Babe Irving III. Welcome, Babe.
Hello, Orbit. It's great being here, man.
It's my pleasure. One of the things that we want our students to understand is that once they become part of a community of musicians, they're in that community for their whole life. You know,
absolutely.
Yeah, you know, we were just talking about how long we've known each other and played in different situations, but you know,
exactly.
Always.
Yeah, always family. I remember back in the day, we used to call everybody was a cat, you know, right. He's the cat. And then we got to the dog generation.
I don't want to get to the old dog generation. But I think it's appropriate to start. I'm going to show a video that was actually not, it's pretty recent of you, a very special project. I was actually in this audience and
wow.
Being a fan of, you know, the bridging of classical and jazz, I was very impressed for two reasons. I mean, your writing, your ensemble, and then also the trumpet player you featured. I was just like, But here's a video. I called it, it's basically your sketches of Brazil.
Yes.
So prep us on that. Just tell a little bit about the project, and then we'll show the clip.
Yeah, so I had done a number of various projects for the Jazz Institute, and they said, well, you know, why don't you do what you want to do this time? So that was coming up on 2009, and I did a little research, and I figured and found out that was the 50th anniversary of Sketches of Spain that Miles and Gil had done in 59. And it also was the 50th anniversary of the death of Heitor Villa-Lobos, the Brazilian composer.
Yes.
And I knew that the album Quiet Nights that followed Sketches of Spain
right.
was actually intended to be their Sketches of Brazil. But it never came together. It was never finished. And of course, Tio Macero released tracks without Miles' permission. And that created this big rift between
the producer.
Them. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And so then when Miles, and I were together, he kind of had that urge again to do orchestral music. And he asked Gil, and Gil was just not, Gil Evans, the arranger,
right.
who had done Sketches of Spain.
Yes.
He just didn't have the energy. He was kind of coasting along, playing at Sweet Basil's every Tuesday with his big band. And so Miles instead asked Gil to school me, basically to sit down with scores, and just talk to me about orchestration and arranging. So for me, this felt like this was a dream or a desire that Miles had that was never fulfilled. And so I felt like I was sort of completing that dream for him, you know, by bringing this, and especially on the anniversary of this convergence of birthdays and the passing of Villa-Lobos.
So let's see the clip.
Okay.
Thank you. Oh, man. That is unbelievable. It's too short. We need more time to show the whole thing, man. Oh, man. So you're from Chicago, is that correct?
Yeah. I was born and raised here. But I had an opportunity to grow up 8 years in North Carolina, sort of by chance.
Okay.
When my mother passed away, we would make the trip from New York, D.C., and North Carolina every summer. So what's ironic is that it was people I met in North Carolina that led me to work with Miles when I got back.
Is that right? Oh.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. Wow. So before we talk about Miles, talk about some of your other experiences, like some of the things that led to it. And of course, after Miles, you got a chance to do some of the most amazing things as well.
Well, so yeah, just picking up from that time when I was in North Carolina, I had a big band down there, not a big band per se, but a top 40 band.
Okay.
And we did a lot of Earth, Wind & Fire cover music. I started off as a horn player. I guess you know that
in high school.
Yeah, I was a brass player.
A trumpet player?
So I started with mellophone, moved to cornet, vowel trombone, baritone horn. I still own a baritone and a trombone. And even tuba at times. And so I went to Hirsch High School on the south side after that. And I was in the concert band. But George Hunter, who's the music teacher, he stressed that all the horn players, if you were interested in jazz, to learn piano as a way to envision what you do in a linear fashion, more stretched out, and to be able to see the harmonies and be able to feel the movement. And so I was one of those students who asked a lot of questions. He kept me after class and showed me just very basic exercises that really gave me the big picture of everything pretty quickly. And by the time I got to North Carolina, I was playing just anything I heard, I could play it in all 12 keys. Because that was the training that we got, you know, from that.
Yeah.
And so I kind of went into the idea of, well, I know music, I'm doing music, so I'm going to study business. So I did business administration studies and became an insurance agent concurrent to having my top 40 band in North Carolina. And then it was the president of the company, it was a black insurance company, North Carolina Mutual. And the president was a former sax player. And he said, Irving, he says, you know, I didn't follow my passion, which was music. He says, I'm doing this, but I would rather be doing what you're doing. He said, I've heard a lot about your band and everything. He said, says, if I were you, I'd get the heck out of North Carolina. Wow. And so eventually I did. And I came back to Chicago and immediately kind of hooked up with people that led me to work with Ramsey Lewis. So I actually was working with Ramsey before Miles.
Oh.
And I was doing theater with the Coulomba Theater Company. There was a show called The Little Dreamer, Night in the Life of Betsy Smith, that featured Kansas Fields on drums and Ernest Dawkins on clarinet.
Yes, yeah.
And Aaron Dodd on tuba. So that was my first arranging job.
Yeah.
And I got to study with little brother Montgomery, who was just a fabulous pianist. Yeah.
Okay, I have to ask you, why Chicago and not New York?
Well, you know, actually, the former boss at the insurance company said, well, you should move to New York or L.A. But I had roots here. We talked about friends for life. Mm-hmm. I had spent 2 years of high school here. So I developed these contacts, one being Gregory Bibb. I don't know if you remember Gregory.
Uh-huh.
But Gregory was the president of the band and student council at Hirsch. And he was, at that time, working for Shy Sound Records as a producer. He was working for Walter Jackson.
Oh, yeah.
And he was one of the few people that I stayed in touch with while I was in North Carolina. So I knew, you know, that if I just plugged into Gregory, he was plugged into everybody else.
Sure.
And
sure.
That's kind of how it began. And so I'm glad that it was Chicago because I met who would be my future wife. And then through her sister, Lillian Tynes, who's married to Phil Perry now, she invited me to a party for Debbie Dunn, the wife of Larry Dunn, the keyboard player for Earth, Wind & Fire.
Yeah.
And it was at the home of Charles Stephanie, the arranger, who had passed on. So I'm here at the party, and everybody wanted to sing Earth, Wind & Fire songs because this is Debbie Dunn's party. And I knew all of them because my band in North Carolina had played these songs.
Oh,
and so at that party were people who including Randy Hall and Vince Wilburn, Miles's nephew.
Yes.
And that was sort of how everything kind of began.
Okay, so a message for our students, there's so much, but one, hold on to your friends.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, because you never know. And two, I would be learn a lot of songs, you know, and
that's
be
right.
Flexible, yeah. Be versatile, because you really don't know. I mean, you did not know when you came back that's what the things that you said that you did, you didn't know beforehand that that's what you were going to do.
Exactly. There was no idea. No.
Right. So going back to the film, the clip that we showed, I don't have the expression to even mention Wallace Roney, especially in light of where we are right now and the reason why we are doing everything virtually.
Yes.
Wallace was the first person that I heard who had passed from COVID-19.
Yes, exactly. And ironically, he was just here about a month before that at the Jazz Showcase.
Right.
And I was there. And the next morning, before he left, I set up a video taping an interview with him because I'm working on a documentary film project. And he and it's on piano players. And he had actually gotten Willie Pickens, who we also lost about 3 years ago.
Yeah.
He had gotten Willie the gig with Elvin Jones. And I knew the story, but I wanted the story on tape.
Yeah.
And so he generously agreed to do that. And I went to his hotel, we set up a green screen and two cameras. And that was his last interview, the last interview with Wallace Roney. And he actually talked about a lot of other things off the record.
I could imagine.
Yeah.
And particularly Miles, because I mean, it's very obvious when he plays that, you know, it's like Miles is back, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And he takes Miles to a whole different direction, I guess.
Yes. You absolutely. Know, yes.
Which is what we as musicians are supposed to do.
Yes.
With our mentors and with our heroes, we learn and we put our personality into it.
Yes, indeed.
Wow. Indeed. Wow. Oh, that's awesome. But speaking of Miles, I mean, one of the things I guess, and everybody knows, that if we were to start a conversation on who were the most influential, I don't like the word greatest because in jazz you can't even use that EST because is there, you know, great. It's like,
yes,
you know, but you know, in terms of popular or popular culture, when history is written, and there's probably three people that will be mentioned as the greatest of the greatest jazz musicians. Mm-hmm. We would probably say Duke Ellington.
Yes.
And oh man, it's hard because John Coltrane or okay, but let's say Louis Armstrong.
Yeah.
But then,
yes.
Of course, Miles Davis.
Yes.
And you know, it took me a while to get into Miles because I was also in that top 40 vein, and I was, you know, as far as this flashy trumpet players and Freddie Hubbard and Lee Morgan. Yeah. Miles comes along, but you know, for me, came along mm-hmm. late. And I'm like, mm-hmm. man, why don't he just Why is he so laid back?
Laid back.
When's he gonna do this? I want him to do this. It took me years to understand that, but the aspect of influence. So, tell us about the influence that Miles Davis had on you.
Wow, it's just endless. It's endless, and part of it you just hit on it. It was his reserve and his pacing. And I remember he said to me once. He said we were in Holland or we were in Denmark somewhere, and it was a day off. He was painting and I was working on an arrangement for him
mm-hmm.
at his suite. And he said to me, Bobby, he says, I've been meaning to ask you why you play like you got the Holy Ghost. And so, you know, we know what that means coming from the church. And I grew up in a holiness church, but I have a lot of family members who are ministers. So that meant one thing to me, but then I also understood that it was a rhetorical question, and so I never answered it. But then he came back about 15 minutes later, and he just clarified what he meant, and he said, "Don't play a single note unless you really mean it."
Mm.
And I got from that he demanded musical integrity, economy. And kind of just showing up with intentionality in the music. And so that was a big takeaway for me. It changed my whole approach, not only to to playing, but to composition. Mm-hmm. And so I tended to only create what I heard in me, in my essence, in my spirit, you know, and to give that, because if you do that, then that's what's going to reach people in that same place that resonates with what that is.
And, you know, that's so important to note, because Miles, when he was 19, in search of Charlie Parker, you know, jazz, if we call it jazz during the time, mm-hmm. was so inundated with swing and, in a sense, kind of watered down, mm-hmm. where the focus was not on the artist and the artistry and the virtuosity. You know, most bands featured the singers and the musicians took a backstage.
Yeah, that's right.
In the 50s. So, but in for Miles to be in search of his heroes, it was all about that flash. It was about Dizzy, you know, and Charlie Parker. But literally 1-2 years later, Miles takes a turn and becomes so introspective that, yeah. that became his, it was his personality, but it became that Miles Davis trademark.
Absolutely. And, you know, and believe it or not, you know, I've talked to people who were very close to Miles during the time that he was coming to Chicago, mm-hmm. and hanging out a lot. And part of that period was during the time when Ahmad Jamal had a club here called Alhambra. Mm-hmm. And Miles was there hanging out and just listening. And a lot of people say, well, Ahmad Jamal was a cocktail piano player. That's how they characterized him at that time. Uh-huh. But he of course had a lot more depth and introspection, and Miles heard that, and he was influenced by that. And I don't think Ahmad Jamal is given as much credit for that influence. But if you listen to a lot of the songs, there are about 4 or 5 songs that Ahmad Jamal recorded, that Miles recorded, the same songs during the Birth of the Cool period that were orchestrated by Gil. Right. The same voice leadings and the same movement as what Ahmad Jamal had laid down on the piano.
Yeah.
So I think Charlie Parker and those guys, they recognized that contrast and that complementary aspect of what Miles did compared to what they did playing all over the place. Mm-hmm. And so there was that tension and release that he could create with just one note. I love the story of Herbie. That Herbie's playing
Herbie
So What. Yeah, Herbie Hancock is playing So What. And he said he just tried to explore some other areas. And he played this note, this chord that sounded so wrong. You know, it just sounded horrible. And he stopped playing momentarily. And then Miles heard it and he turned his head and then he played a note that made it sound so right.
Check it out.
So, yeah. You know, so there you go. And so it's like Miles would make what we call chromatic accidentals, and you know, and make them an actual expression of invention,
right?
Inventionism, yeah.
And he seemed to always know where the music was going.
Yes,
and mm-hmm. set it up well. And there's a place where there's a video of you playing with Miles, and well, first of all, Miles would just, the band would just be open. Now see, that makes me a nervous wreck being a conductor, right? and conductor, because I'm like, I gotta, you know, the classical side of me says, here it is, let's keep it here. I'm in charge. I get to see where it goes. Miles would basically just look and listen and then he'd point.
Right.
So he comes over to you and puts his arm around you.
Right.
Okay. I have to know, well, first of all, let's look at the clip.
Okay.
Okay, wow. So, man, I just have to ask, like, what in the world was he telling you, if you remember?
Well, actually, you know, he was funny. There was this period of time when he just kind of took it upon himself to want to kind of introduce the band and introduce everybody. And so I was not alone. But he was trying to make me get me to bow. Me to take a literal bow. It's like, oh, take a bow. It's like, oh, I just want to go play.
Right.
But we were always also competing with fashion. You know, how he would dress. It was all designer fashion.
Yeah.
And I was the only one that kind of would go shopping and find stuff. A lot of the guys would just wear jeans and a shirt. He would call me into the dressing room before the gig so he could see what I was wearing. And if it was something really cool and new, then he would say, oh, get out of here, you know, like, and then he'd come on stage, you know, and he'd look at me, I got you.
But that's something about Miles, even, I mean, from the, man, late 50s, that this sense of style, and there's pictures of him and his wife, Frances.
Oh, yeah.
That are like, I mean, she was a dancer in New York, man, they would just stop traffic.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
and that's important for the time, especially, where America was in terms of racial relations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we didn't have the glamour side of things as far as magazines or TV shows, things like that. It was very limited. But for Miles to be this icon, I mean, and it wasn't just how he looked, man. It's how he acted, man.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, it was the attitude, you know. He you know, he was painting by the time I was there. He was really full scale into the art. And I was so surprised to get over there and see him work in nice clothes. He would dress up in very nice clothes to paint. He wouldn't wear a painter's smock or anything. It was just, and I asked him, "What, Miles, aren't you afraid of getting your clothes, with getting paint on your clothes?" He says, "Well, it just makes me feel," he says, "it makes me feel better. It puts me more in the vibe and the mood. He says, I got to feel good in order to create."
Wow. But so for our students, we can put Miles and his influences in different categories. Of course, we talked about the bebop. And
yes.
And almost right away, just a few years later, there was this sense of the birth of the cool.
Yes.
You know? And then, he took Third Stream in totally different direction, as you said, with his collaboration with Miles and Gil. And all these things, and we got to talk about the prestige recordings of 59.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. You know,
there's this time where it's like months. He recorded so much music.
Yeah.
But then recorded the greatest, and I use that term loosely, in terms of commercialism, album, or even most influential album, which was Kind of Blue.
Yes.
And 1959, when you think about it, civil rights was just brewing. You know, it was just like, man, things were going crazy and leading up to a peak in terms of like kind of, we think about what we just went through with George Floyd, you know, and all the emotions that are tied up in that. So, but then Miles puts out this album, Kind of Blue. 1959 is like saying, wait.
Yeah.
Cool out.
Cool out, just chill. Just chill. Yeah.
And even now, man, that album, I gotta hear it. I gotta hear it.
Yeah, there's absolutely nothing like it. Yeah, and you're right in the timing of it. And those prestige albums, a lot of that music didn't come out until much, much later. A lot of it got canned.
Oh, that's right.
There was a tune, Kilo.
I played that with you.
You played it with me.
I sure did.
Yeah, and you know, I talked to Busta Williams and different guys. They had never heard of it because it was hell.
Yeah.
And but that was, you know, Miles was 26 years old, I would think, or 27 or something. Yeah. Art Blakey was that. They were all young. They were all like young lions, really. Then, you know.
Oh my goodness.
The Heath Brothers, and it was amazing time.
Yeah, and
they were way ahead of the time in that sense.
But Miles, I've read that he never really looked back.
He didn't.
No. He didn't. So even in your conversations backstage over dinner, did he ever like reflect like the glory days? He just.
Well, you know, he did. He did. But most of it, invariably, 50% of the time, he was talking about B, which is Billy Eckstein. That's who you call him, B.
Really?
And because that was the most impressionable time. If you think about it, this was his first big gig. You know, he gets pulled in, you know, and he's not considered to be a virtuoso, you know, like Dizzy and other guys who come through the band. But Eckstein loved what he brought, you know, that essence.
Yeah.
And so it was the most impressionable time in his life, being a young man. So right. So you can see why that would stay with him, you know, for years. You know, he would always become a kid again whenever he talked about Billy Eckstein.
Oh wow! So later on, Miles, of course, was so, you know, moving forward, and he actually went fusion a lot sooner than you know, you would expect, because he's already at the peak. But I think it was his relationship with Jimi Hendrix.
Yes,
that threw him into this, man. I gotta get me a red sports car.
Yeah,
but then I bring that up to say that he, I don't know whether we could say prematurely or it was a conscious decision. He stopped.
Yes, he did.
And put the horn down. You know, and so earlier, Mark, Arthur, and I were talking about it, and Arthur actually had the best, because Arthur is a musicologist as well. Uh-huh. And I was like, Arthur, you got to come on and ask this question yourself. So, Arthur, hey, Arthur Turnbull. So, you got to go ahead. You got the floor.
Thank you for giving me this opportunity. The period that you worked with Miles in the early 1980s, you know, was a period of him coming out of exile, and I know that he had a very serious car accident in the early 70s that sidelined him for a number of years. We have a lot of campers, and a lot of them, I'm looking at the screen with just a lot of faces on it, and I wanted to talk about, if you could speak on Miles always wanting to work with younger musicians as part of this way that he always found a way to stay relevant. And do you have any insight on that period of him, you know, coming back to playing again after not playing for so many years, but still choosing to work with some old friends like Al Foster, for example, but also some new folks, yourself,
Thank you,
Marcellus, Kenny Garrett,
Bill Evans, the
Daryl Jones, Orbit's friend Daryl Jones,
who's now
the touring bassist for the Rolling Stones.
Yeah.
And why younger musicians, Marcus Miller, but why younger musicians were such a fuel for him, even after coming off of a period where it would seem safe to go with the people that he knew and had already worked with and still found success going into the 80s in this last phase of his career?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very good question. You know, for all of us, it was quite serendipitous. This goes back a little bit to what I was just saying to Orbit about the way Miles was brought in by Dizzy and Billy Eckstein at such a young age, and I think he kind of kept that mentality of giving back and bringing up the next generation. I think he felt an obligation. You got to remember, though, that during that 7 years, he was a recluse. He was not playing the horn. He was not doing music very much at all. He may have gone in the studio just a couple times with M. Toomey and some of those guys, but he never was happy with the results. And so by the time that I'm back in Chicago and I'm rehearsing with a band called Data, and then we changed the name to AL7. It was Miles' nephew, Vince Wilburn, Randy Hall on guitar. And Felton Cruz on bass, and Felton actually now is he just received the honor of being in the Blues Hall of Fame.
Really?
We had a couple of different saxophone players. Anyway, Miles would listen to the music on the phone during our rehearsals, and we would get on the phone and he would make commentary about it and everything. And he was just a voice on the phone. I knew what he had done, but he hadn't been on the scene. So there was a tune that I wrote called Space. And it was a funk fusion tune with clavinet. And he was just fascinated by the elements of it, the mini Moog bass part on there. And he kept having Vince to play it over the phone. Finally, he asked for a cassette tape. And Vince sent the cassette. And so the next thing you know, he called and said, can you come to New York and record the tune? And I'm just like, well, of course. But when we got there, there was no plan for him to do an album or to do comeback or anything. He just wanted to record that one tune.
Wow.
But we ended up being there for 2 months, and we set up a workshop in his brownstone. So I think it was the interaction with this young energy And the fact that we have sort of one foot in the past and one in the into the future. And he was just turned on by that because there was nothing to excite him in terms of where this music was going. But now all of a sudden he's excited. And he still had not played the horn. He was playing an organ. He was playing the, he rented a Farfisa organ. And he would just lay on this F sharp, sharp triad on top of a A pedal that was like, just like, but it would push you into other areas. And so one day he said, let's go in the studio and record. So we go in the studio and we would record for about a month and a half, but Miles still had not picked up a horn. So T.L. Macero, the producer, said, you know, Bobby, this is good. This is all sounds great, but it's nothing without the horn of Miles. And so because of what had happened in the past, T.O. couldn't say that to Miles without getting punched. And so on the ride home in the limo, I said to Miles, I said, Miles, you know, we'd love to get some trumpet on this stuff. He says, what's wrong? You don't like my organ playing? I said, well, man. Yeah, we love your organ playing, but, you know, we really need to feel that the man with the horn, literally. Mm. And so he said, yeah, I know. So we were sent home after it was apparent that when he came to the studio the next Monday, he brought his horn in the Orbit, as you know very well, that Miles had it here. He had it here. He had it here, but he didn't have it here.
Take a day off. That's me.
And he sounded like a beginner. He really sounded like a beginner, but yeah. He saw our disappointment. He saw the disappointment that because he, you know, we looked up to him as young people. And that was September. By about Christmas, he called me and said, Bobby, check this out. And he was blowing in the background. And you could tell, okay, he's been working all that time to get back to that point.
Yeah, that's cool.
So I think it was just a combination of just the inspiration, the synergy of that inspiration. He inspired us, we inspired him. And there was this exchange of energy that just sort of catapulted him back to the forefront. And he just kept riding that wave, you know?
That's awesome, man. You're giving us such firsthand information that is so valuable. But unfortunately, we only have a few minutes left. So Bobby, do you have any advice that you would, that if you could, to go back to tell the young Robert Irving III, what would you tell him?
Wow, that's a very good question. So I would just say, in all the travels, to observe, to be more observant, to have your ears and eyes open, and to not take anything for granted, even the most small encounter, brief encounter, has meaning, and that there's music in everything and everywhere. Miles was being interviewed once, and they asked him. He says, "We see you at the basketball game, the Lakers game. Are you a big fan?" He says, "I'm not there for the game." He said, "I'm there for the rhythm."
Oh man!
And so it goes back to the James Brown premise that, you know, every instrument is a drum. And so Miles was a frustrated drummer, and I'm a frustrated drummer too. And I think I recognize in myself that piano is a percussion instrument. And so as I approach music, then I'm approaching it from the perspective of rhythm. Mm. And so just listening and hearing and feeling, and then the next thing would be to act, to not lay back, but to be a human doing. You can be a human being, but you got to be a human doing sometimes.
Very cool.
Okay, we got a couple of final questions from a couple of our students for you, Bobby. Just quick questions. This is from Donovan and Benjamin. What other artists have you worked with other than Miles?
Oh, okay. Wow, so long, long list. Well, I produced two albums for Terry Lynn Carrington, which was the first one. Everybody was on it, and so I ended up producing sessions with George Duke, with Grover Washington Jr., with Wayne Shorter, which is really funny stories with Wayne. I did four albums with Ramsey Lewis and didn't do a lot of touring with him, only just a couple of dates with Ramsey. Yep. But we're lifelong friends, yeah.
And then the last question from Mohan, he wants to know, what is your favorite type of jazz?
My favorite type of jazz is jazz that's playing. So all of it. I don't think there's any bad jazz. And there's so many categories. There's 50 categories of jazz. And I think it's the most expansive music that exists. And so that's my answer.
Wow. Well, I want to personally thank you because I was asked once, because my last name is Davis, and people say,
that's right.
Right to Miles. I say the closest I got to Miles was to play on a demo in Bobby Irving's apartment where he was writing a Miles Davis song and had me come and play with the music.
That's right. That's right.
I'll never forget that because you told me that Bobby said, he said, man, who's this dude trying to sound like me?
That's right.
But again, that's what we have to do. Young trumpet players, I'm not young anymore, but young trumpet players, young musicians, develop your sound by listening to the masters. And
yes.
I'm just elated that I had this short time with you, a master, a true master, Chicago's own, my friend. Everybody give Robert Bobby Irving a virtual applause.
That concludes this episode of the Chicago Jazz Philharmonic Jazz Cast Series. We really appreciate you tuning in. Sharing these stories wouldn't be possible without the support of listeners like you. To hear previous episodes, make a donation, or to simply learn more about our mission, please visit us at chicagojazzphilharmonic.org. See you next time for the Chicago Jazz Philharmonic Conversation Series.